3. The witch's house sat deep in the woods. Beyond the forest, far in the distance, rose a range of volcanic mountains. At their base stood Earth's last settlement on this Venusian continent, which the Earthmen had called Lucille Town, perhaps named by its founder for some long bygone sweetheart. Beyond it lay only the unknown of the primeval Venusian wildlands. "There is no Sunday west of Lucille Town," so the colonists said, "and no god west of Portsmouth." Though in that, as Cult and Charol were soon to find out, the colonists could not have been more wrong. "So, brother," Yarrow said, "what do you have for me?" They were in her house. It was simply but tastefully decorated, and a fire burned violet in the hearth, sending plumes of scented smoke into the air. Cheryl opened the string and drew the dead man's head from the bag.
"Ach, it stinks," Colt said.
The head looked bad. The Venusian weather had not been kind to it, and it was beginning to decompose. Yarrow said, "You should have brought it to me sooner." Cheryl shrugged.
"Can you speak with it still?"
"I can try." She took the head from him. She was dressed now in a plain shift that rippled around her. She held the head in both hands, staring into its dead, glassy eyes. At last, Yarrow shook her head. "Perhaps," she murmured, "though he has long gone down the dark path." She gestured for them to follow her. Colt moved sluggishly, the smoke making his senses dull and pleasant. Yarrow opened the door to a second room. The air was colder there. A curious contraption stood in the middle of the room. It was as if it had grown out of the ground, a blunt trunk surrounded by many twisting branches that spread out and in again upon themselves like tentacles. Yarrow placed the dead man's head on the trunk. She began to bend the branches, attaching them one by one to the head, pushing them deep into the melting skin and reluctant bone. Colt gritted his teeth, but did not look away. When it was done, the head had been penetrated multiple times by the branches, and Yarrow took a position in the tangle of branches. This time, it was as though the tree itself was responding to her. The branches moved, snaking under Yarrow's shift, attaching themselves to her. She began to murmur words in a language Cult did not understand. Her eyes closed, and a faint blue light began to glow along the branches of the tree, spreading out from Yarrow to the disembodied head. Colt stared in horrified fascination as the air began to fizz and hiss with a powerful discharge. Yarrow began to shake, engulfed by cold fire. The dead man blinked. Colt stared. This could not be happening, surely. The head blinked again. Then it opened its mouth and screamed. Colt took an involuntary step back and bumped into Charol, who held him steady. Yarrow made a sharp gesture, and the dead man immediately fell silent.
"There is not much there," Yarrow said.
"Try," Charol said, gripping Colt's arm.
Yarrow closed her eyes. The head opened its mouth again. It began to speak.
"Drown in the swamp. Rogue, rogue, see him come. The man from the stars has a whip for a heart, heart of a star. The fire burns. He promised us wealth, but made us into slaves. I alone escaped, but they follow, they follow. Untold treasure, all you desire, but the treasure is death. Do not seek your fortune on the steps of the temple, north by northwest. Make it focus, give us a route,
Cheryl cried, his excitement infecting Colt. Treasure, he thought. He pushed out of his mind the dead man's warnings. Dead men could not be trusted at the best of times. Yarrow was shaking, sweat pouring down her face, turning her shift damp. It clung to her body. Colt was aware of the curve of her backside, of her nipples, small and hard, like her brother's. The blue flames shot upward, and over the dead man's head a picture began to form, hazy at first, but gaining definition. It showed the volcanic peaks of a nearby mountain range, and beyond it a mighty river snaking through marshland and swamps. Here and there, through the thick canopy of the trees, Colt could see smoke rising from unseen villages. Venusian settlements no Earthman had ever seen. The picture rushed forward, and suddenly he saw an ancient temple rising out of a clearing in the jungle, on the banks of a great swamp into which the river fed as it passed. There, Cheryl said. At the sound of his voice, Yarrow dropped her arms. She fell to her knees, the branches making slick, wet sounds as they detached from her. The image faded away, and the disembodied head was silent once more. Yarrow! Cheryl went to her, kneeling by her side. Yarrow shuddered, her eyes fluttered open, but what horror she saw, neither of them could see. Ruth, she said, and her voice was a pitiful howl of pain and rage and fear. Ruth! 4. There is a special monotony to travel on Venus. You who have sampled perhaps the volcanic isles of Earth's South Pacific Ocean or the thick jungles of that planet's interior may think you understand something of its nature, but you would be wrong. There is something crushing to the soul in the ever-present cloud cover, never a release from the humidity and heat, never the sight of blue skies or the rolling green hills of which the blind poet Risling famously wrote. He had not been fond of Venus, if Colt correctly recalled, writing of it as rotten, wretched, foul, and filled with death. Well, what do you expect from a drunken old poet, was Colt's take on it. For travelling for days through jungle and swamp, and sailing the majestic river, which the Venusian swamp men call the Mukhtar, and some worship as a god, Colt began to see Venus through his companion's eyes. This was not the planet that the Earthmen, God-fearing administrators and colonists ever saw. Through Cheryl's eyes, Colt saw the beauty hidden in the interaction of clouds, for which the Venusians have as many as 50 or 100 different names. He saw the swirl of hidden currents in the river, and smelled the smoke of hidden villages, and that earthy, if unearthly, stink of the swamps, which the Venusians savour like a fine wine. Venus was a planet of secrets and hidden depths of mysteries beyond recall. And as they travelled, their affinity deepened, his and Cheryl's, and in the privacy of their small, leaf-like boat, they consummated that special bond that only men can share with other men. Sometimes in the dark hours it seemed to Colt that he saw a brightness in the sky, like a false sun in the distance, followed by the inevitable sound of a distant explosion. He did not comment on it, and neither did Cheryl, but he had noticed it ever since they had left Port Smith, and it made him think of the Sun Eater that he had inadvertently saved. Cheryl, Colt said. It was night, and in the distance the dwellers called to each other across the swamps. The night was thick with humidity and the buzzing of flying insects drawn to the boat's dim light.
Yes?
What is that sound? Cheryl went very still. His small, keen ears moved in a manner no Earthman's could. Scanning, Colt listened too. The sound of the water had changed. It was deeper, quicker. A rumble in the distance growing closer. "Rapids!" Cult cried, just as Sherrill's smaller body hit his, sending both of them overboard. The water was surprisingly cold, sending a shudder up Cold's spine. Sherrill was a shadow beside him. "Hold on to me," Sherrill called. The current took their boat away. Ahead, white foam rose into the air and a roar entered Cult's ears. The falls were close. Too close. The current dragged them fast. Cult began to panic when he felt Sherrill's hand tightening on his arm, pulling him with force. They had stopped. He turned and saw a thick tangle of dark roots rising out of the water. Sherrill, a shadow amidst them. They were the roots of an Atongtong tree, which spread out underwater. The current pulled at them. Cult held fast to Sherrill's hand, then onto one of the roots. They began to drag themselves laboriously along the thick, slimy roots, holding on for their lives. At last they made the bank. They lay on the wet mud, breathing deeply and hoarsely. Cult stared out at the thundering smoke overhead. A mere 100 feet farther, and they would have plunged to their deaths. He smiled weakly. "Well, that was a close call," he said. Sherrill said nothing. "Sherrill?" He turned his head, but Sherrill wasn't there. Cult pushed himself up, alarmed. The mud clung to his skin. Footprints on the ground, he scrambled up the slope from the river, hands and feet clawing for purchase. He came over the rise when a hand grabbed him roughly by the shoulder and forced him down.
"Hush, you fool!"
Cult lay belly down in the mud next to Sherrill and saw. It rose out of the bank, more immense than anything Cult could have imagined. What vanished race had once possessed such advanced technology as to erect this temple complex? Vast stone pillars rose high into the sky, each the size and height of many men. Giant statues were erected amidst them, of fantastical, vanished beings, the Shamblo and the Thag and the Nameless, and towering above all, a chain of vast pyramids starkly illuminated against the violet sky, amidst which dark shapes flittered and fled, rising and soaring through the air.
"What is this place?"
Cult whispered, awed. But Sherrill's reply never came. In its stead, there came the unmistakable sound of multiple energy guns, all charging in unison. Cult glanced wildly sideways. Dark shapes rose all around them, enclosing them in a trap from which there was no escape.
"What is this place?"
It was a voice with a twang of earth in it, a rich and melodious voice in which amusement and contempt intermingled. A small round shape stepped forward, revealing itself as a small rotund man with round glasses and a soft, not unpleasant face.
"It is mine."
Beside Cult, Sherrill was reaching desperately for a gun. Cult grabbed his hand, stopped him. They were outnumbered and outgunned. The small man laughed. There was something familiar about him, about his face and voice, his mannerisms. Cult's eyes opened wide as realization dawned. Old memory returned.
"Van Harsen," he said.
He knew that name, that face, the mining magnate, the rich playboy son of an Earth dynasty who had become the worst despot and warlord the solar system had ever seen. The warlord of Jupiter, they had called him, and the butcher of Europa. No wonder those replicants had seemed familiar. It was Van Harsen who had employed them, in his insane war, become the emperor of the Jovian moons. But surely the man was dead. He had been indicted for countless crimes post-mortem, including for xenocide against the peaceful ocean dwellers of Europa, his army scattered, his replicant soldiers destroyed. Of his 5-year reign, and nothing remained, no statue, no memorial. The most evil man in the solar system, they had called him. Surely, surely he was dead.
Van Housen, yes, yes, I remember that name, the man in the round glasses said thoughtfully. And who might you be? Kill him, Colt, kill him.
Charol was shaking, sweat poured on his face. Colt had never seen him this way. He restrained his friend as best he could, afraid for his life.
Ah, Van Housen said, smiling pleasantly, you have heard of me.
He turned back to Colt, shaking his head.
Venusians, he said, such an emotional race, don't you think? They're like children. They need the firm hand of an adult to guide them. I could use you, yes. One does not waste labor. Bring them.
He ordered his replicant sharply. Colt and Charol were pulled up to their feet. They were led away, deep into the temple complex, into the shadows of the pyramids. 5. In that war, Colt was but a young soldier. He still remembered landing on Europa after the massacre, remembered the corpses of the gentle, whale-like creatures stranded on the ice, their enormous eyes unseeing. Once Europa had sung with a mind song of its peaceful, telepathic inhabitants. But the war had turned that icy moon into a wasteland. 6. A hatred he had thought forgotten, buried deep, frozen, had erupted in him. Captive, helpless, he and Charol were led into the complex. From within, all signs of grandeur were gone, and he could see the place for what it truly was, a ruin. Make no mistake, man has conquered space before, and out of what strange vanished race did this place come? Atlantis? Mu, of which only hints and myths remain? Now the jungle encroached freely into the complex. The trees sent roots to break the stones, upend the statues. Once it must have sat on a raised plateau, but the ground had eroded and the river had come in, swamping the once grand courtyard, turning the earth into fetid pools of stagnant water. They trudged through and around the main pyramid. Beyond, an enormous part lake, part swamp, spread out as far as the eye could see. The water reached up to the lowest level of the pyramids, leaving a black line along the ancient stone. All around the shore, amidst the pyramids, stood Venusian swamp men and women. Colt heard Charol's indrawn breath, the hiss of his anger and disgust. Slaves. They were slaves. Chains linked the Venusians' legs, binding them together. Scattered among them were armed replicants keeping order. The linked chains of slaves were sent into the water, wading deeper and deeper. Lights hovered over the surface, and Colt saw a massive floating platform on which a giant crane stood, extending far over the water. Divers came and went from the platform. It was a salvage operation.
What is under there? Colt said.
Van Housen smiled in evident satisfaction.
Treasure, boy, he said. Treasure the likes of which the solar system has not seen in ends. And you boys will help me recover it.
Rogue!
What was it?
For a moment, Van Housen looked uncomfortable, confused. Then the glint returned to his eyes, and Colt realized with a cold, sickening feeling that the man was quite, quite insane.
Now get to work,
Van Housen roared. The replicants dragged Colt and Charol towards the nearest chain gang. Chains were fastened to their feet. A replicant overseer flicked an energy whip over them with casual contempt, and Cheryl screamed as a strip of skin was burned clean off his back. Colt shuffled along with the Venusians, into the shallows of the water, then deeper. What they were searching for, he didn't know. He knew only that they must find it, or die trying. 7.
Rogue.
8. How long they had been there, Colt didn't know. He had lost track of the passage of time. Their voices were the worst after a while, the incessant murmuring of the mad voice in the lake, calling always, calling to them to bring it out. Rogue! Rogue! It was need and demand, hunger and hate, loathing and desire. It was a command, and they could do nothing but obey. They slept fitfully and rarely were fed a thin gruel. Van Housen and his replicant soldiers had enslaved the swamp men of the nearby villages and now ranged farther and farther, returning each day with new captives. Rogue! It was a weapon. It was a prayer. In time, it almost became Colt's sole reason to live. Almost, but not quite, for he was not alone. Cheryl was with him, Cheryl of the warm skin and the easy laugh, Cheryl of the quick draw. They were partners, and the treasure would be theirs, and revenge with it. They just had to bide their time. Colt was not the only Earthman in the salvage site. There were others there, and Martians, and the men of half a dozen other moons and planets. How they had come to be there, he did not know. They were the dregs of the solar system, easily missed, easily lost, and every day he watched them give their lives to the swamp, and with each agonized death, each beating or drowning, he could feel the thing in the swamp grow stronger, hungrier, and heard his call echoing louder in his mind. Rogue! It is near, he heard Cheryl say, as though from far away. They were standing on the floating platform, illuminated by the harsh glare of floodlights. It is rising. Yes, Colt said, and yes. Rogue! A numbness had spread through him. For 3 days and 3 nights, they had dived from the platform into the depths of the swamp, dredging, searching, knowing they were getting close. It had been easy to be promoted to the platform. No one survived up there long. They were unchained up here. They had to be, to dive and return. Colt had never been so tired. There was no escape from the platform. In the glare of floodlights and the shadows of the ancient pyramids, there was only one way out. Perhaps he had always known that. He adjusted the mask on his face and dove headfirst into the water, and felt Cheryl, a bullet shape beside him. Together they dove deep, their torches illuminating the murky depths. There were others down there, little mechanical submersibles and naked Venusian divers, nets and hooks and rope. And then there were the dead. They were everywhere. They floated in a thick glow of decomposition and decay, staring at Colt with white, milky eyes. Venusians and Earthmen and Martians sacrificed each day for the crazed god at the bottom of the swamp, this Rogue, and with each death it had grown stronger and more insane. It was close. He could feel it now, feel its relentless, hungry pull. How had it taken so long for them to find it, when it was so obviously there, a beacon calling out, warping minds, infecting their dreams? He dove deeper and deeper, Cheryl's muscular body moving beside him with fluid economic grace. a rising shoal of divers converging on this one place. There, in the mud, half buried, ghostly, in the half light of their lamps, it was an enormous stone statue, a savage face like a ritual mask, eyes gouged deep into the stone, shining with bioluminescence. There was both savagery and beauty etched into that stone idol, a hunger, a desire. It was a thing out of Atlantis or Lemuria, the last remnant of its race found here in the last place on or off Earth. A little lost god. The divers converged on the idol. Nets engulfed it, ropes wrapped over it carefully. Colt watched the first of the divers, a small Venusian woman, reach the idol. Perhaps curious, perhaps in her tiredness and despair, lacking caution, she reached out a hand and touched her. For a moment a dreamy look entered her face, palely visible through her mask. Then she simply burst open, like fungal spores or dust, a coalescence of blood and brains, intestines and ovaries. The idol seemed to glow. It sucked in a cloud as if the Venusian had never existed, and it exulted, screaming out in savage joy across all of their minds, "I am Rook!" Still they heaved and secured, and overhead the giant crane began to pull, and slowly, slowly the idol was pulled free of the mud. It rose through the water, an inhuman figure, and yet somehow carved by humans long gone, whose science had become myth and superstition. Cult stared at it in horrified awe and disgust. This was the treasure they had come to find. And now they were its captives. He turned his head and saw Sherol looking at him, and a shared thought passed through their minds, and they began to rise, swimming to the surface. On the platform, Van Housen himself, surrounded by his replica ants, was standing.
"Well?" he demanded. "Well? Is it here? Is it here?"
He reminded Colt at that moment of an ill-tempered, spoiled child, one who had received too many presents, and yet still bullied away those of others. To Van Housen, the idol was just another toy. Colt emerged fully out of the water and caught his breath, shuddering with cold and tension. A moment later, Sherol too rose. He looked ill in the floodlights. Overhead, the crane strained against the weight of the idol. Slowly, the line rose. The divers emerged like a dark cloud in the water. The idol rose. Its great domed head broke the surface of the water. There was a silence all across the swamp and the old ruined temple. "Rook!" Rook was rising again. And no one was paying attention to Colt and Sherol. Again they exchanged glances. They knew each other's minds. Quietly they rose. The idol, pulled entirely out of the water, hung suspended in the air above the swamp. It was magnificent. Magnificent and grotesque. The mud and water sluiced off it, hissing from some immense heat emanating from within the stone. The idol whispered of blood sacrifice and dark rituals, of death magic and the science of pain. Van Housen's eyes were shining. He seemed as enraptured as a child. Colt and Sherol made their way unobtrusively behind the control unit of the crane. On the deck, Van Housen stood with his arms wide open, the waves lapping at his feet. The idol was being lowered toward him. It must have been a weapon once, Colt thought. The ancient remnants of the wars that had torn Lemuria and Atlantis apart and left their children stranded on this and other planets. What could Van Housen do, being in control of it? Colt raised his face to the sky. He missed the stars badly at that moment. Then far in the distance, but coming closer, something like dawn, like the sun. He heard a distant explosion. Cheryl turned to him, a swift glance.
"I've been hearing that sound ever since we left Portsmouth," he said.
Colt shook his head, pointed. A repric ant had wandered a short way away from the others, was just turning toward them, its gun beginning to rise. They took it front and back, Cheryl grabbing the cyborg's gun as Colt kicked its legs out from under it and broke its neck, cleanly, with a twist. He lowered the replic ant gently to the ground, leaning it against the control booth's metal wall. No one had noticed. The chance of escape was now. Colt liberated a beam pistol from the creature's armor. They were armed, and for the moment, they were free. Again, they exchanged looks. The water was near. All they had to do was swim for it. Colt grinned. Cheryl, after a moment, grinned back and hefted his gun. It felt good, Colt thought, to have a gun again. You always knew where you were with a gun.
"Welcome, rogue of Lemuria, risen again after millennia."
They stepped around the control unit. The idol had been lowered onto the deck. Its eyes had not lost their weird, ethereal glow. In the distance, a false sun growing closer. Van Housen spread open his arms.
"You, who were worshipped as a god," he said, "will now meet one who has lived as one."
And so saying, he stepped forward and embraced the monstrous stone statue, placing his lips on the idol's own in a lustful, obscene kiss.
"No," Cheryl said.
"Now," Colt said. They stepped out in unison and began to fire. The replic ants were taken by surprise, if such creatures can be said to be capable of surprise. The beams hissed through the air, agitating water molecules as they passed. The air filled with steam. Replic ants dropped. Others turned, firing. Colt knew they could not win, that this was suicide. Yet a savage joy sang through him as he fired, rolled, grabbed a weapon from the hands of a downed cyborg, and continued to mow down Van Housen's guard. This was revenge, and revenge was a dish best served with guns. Van Housen still had his arms wrapped around the statue. Now he turned his head back to look at them, an irritated frown crossing his face. That was what Colt always remembered afterward, that petulant look on the butcher of Europa's face a moment before it changed forever. At first, it was simple confusion. Then a nameless terror entered the man's eyes, and milky clouds began to pour into his retina. His body shuddered, spasming uncontrollably, and he began to scream. Colt was cornered by two replic ants, his arm and face bleeding and burned. He faced them, ready to die. But no shot came. Colt stared at the replic ants, but they were unmoving. Just ahead, Van Housen was still screaming, fused into the rock. Colt said, "Cheryl?"
"Yes," came the reply from the other side of the platform.
"Are you still alive?"
"Yes."
There was a short silence.
"You?"
"I?"
"Yes."
"Sure?" Colt shrugged. He grabbed the beam gun from the nearest replic ant, smashed in the creature's face, then fired in a long beam, low and wide, turning, leaving around him a circle of corpses.
"I'm pretty sure," he said.
In the distance there was the sound of an explosion, like thunder, but it was not thunder. Colt thought that he could see the sun, but that was impossible on Venus. In the water, the Venusian swamp men and women stared up at the two of them, mutely. Sherral?
Yes.
They're staring.
Right.
Sherral came and joined him, cutting a swathe of dead and broken replic ants in his wake.
You,
Colt said, addressing the Venusians in the water. They looked up at him in mute incomprehension.
Shoo, Colt said. Shoo. Get out of here,
Sherral said. Still they did not move. He sighed, adjusted the setting on his gun, and began to fire into the water.
Go away! Get back to your villages! Hurry!
A panic broke in the water, and the Venusians, as one, began to swim to shore. Colt and Sherral, standing side by side in the glare of the one remaining floodlight, watched them come ashore, like a dark tide. Soon they were gone amidst the pyramids. The sudden silence was broken by a human laugh, the sound of hands clapping.
Bravo,
the voice said. Colt turned slowly. Van Housen was standing beside the idol, but the idol's eyes no longer shone, and there was something indescribably alien and disgusting in Van Housen's face, something that used to be his eyes.
Bravo!
It's still here,
Sherral said.
Shoot it,
Colt said. The face that had belonged to Van Housen smiled. Colt and Sherral opened fire. Van Housen staggered back, still smiling. Then he stopped and breathed deep. His chest inflated. He seemed to grow bigger and meaner in that time. He took a step forward. He was unharmed.
Roog,
he said softly. His tongue snaked out, red and fleshy, like a Martian cactus. He licked his lips. His teeth were like stone, and there was mud leaking from his eyes and ears. He opened his mouth wide.
Roog,
he roared. His tongue snaked out and continued to emerge a vast red snake. It looped around Sherral and pulled him to the ground. Colt fired, but the beams bounced harmlessly off of the monster.
Sherral! Run! Save yourself!
There was the sound of an explosion closer this time. Waves lashed the platform, almost upending Colt. Van Housen grew bigger and bigger still. His tongue, a red pulsating tentacle, tightened over Sherral's helpless body. Van Housen's weight was making the platform lean. The crane was tilting alarmingly, swinging as the platform rocked. Colt fired, helplessly, sweat pouring down his face. He threw down the gun and ran to his friend.
Roog! Roog! Roog!
Go, Sherral whispered. He reached out a hand, stroked Colt's cheek.
Colt, go!
I'm not leaving you.
Save yourself.
Colt shook his head. There was sweat in his eyes. He blinked. The Roog was by now enormous. Van Housen's body bloated outward, muscles and skin and blood vessels stretched. He towered over them, as tall as a crane now.
I am Roog, Lemuria, he cried. Shall rise again.
Red tongues lashed out of his enormous mouth, tentacles reaching out for Colt, sinking into the lake, questing, hungering. Colt was going to get taken. The ancient god was going to devour them both. He squeezed Sherral's hand. At least we found it, he said, trying to smile. The treasure.
Fool,
Sherral said. The breath was leaving him. The monster's tongue wrapped itself around Colt. There was no escape. It was slimy and wet and hot. He felt its pull, tried to fight against it. Overhead, the giant risen god's laugh boomed across the sky. No, Colt realized. It was a different sound intruding on his consciousness. It was a sound of explosions, and the air felt hot and dry. The Roog stopped laughing. Its head turned this way and that. It looked annoyed.
Who dares disturb the mighty Roog?
he said. His voice had the petulance of Van Housen still in it. His tentacle eased the pressure on Cult just a little. He looked up. The sun burned in the purple Venusian sky. It dispelled clouds and illuminated the night, casting shadows and reflections on the water. It was the sun the blind poet Reisling had spoken of when he described feeling its warmth on his skin and knowing that he was back home amidst the green hills of Earth. And it cried. It cried out in song. It was not the sun, but Sun-Eater, Charol whispered. Colt's eyes filled with tears as he stared into the glare, saw amidst the flames the lizardine body, the leathery wings of the Sun-Eater. It turned enormous diamond eyes on Colt, as though it could see every part of him, which perhaps it could. Then it gave a cry of anger and rushed at the bloated god. The tentacles eased off Colt and Charol as the Roog turned to his attacker, his mouth opening in rage. Tentacles whipped through the air, trying to wrap around the Sun-Eater. But the heat from the flying creature burned them clean off, and the Roog cried with anger and pain. Chunks of tongue fell down to the water, red and hissing. The Sun-Eater flew at the Roog, gouging deep chunks of meat out of its grotesque human shape, which splashed down into the water as large as pyramid blocks. Colt grabbed Charol's shoulders. The Roog's attention was off them. Charol had lost consciousness. Colt began to drag him to the edge of the platform. Overhead, the Sun-Eater was a ball of flame, but the Roog had stretched his massive lips into a nasty smile, and a new tongue appeared and licked his red flesh. His giant hands reached for the crane and tore it free. The Sun-Eater, turning in a graceful swirl, was coming back at the Roog. The Roog screamed incoherent laughter and rage and swung the giant crane like a bat. Colt could only watch in horrified incomprehension as the crane connected with the Sun-Eater's body with a sickening crunch. For a moment, there was silence, and the sun seemed suspended in the air. Then it fell, like dusk, slowly and inexorably, and hit the deck. The platform shook, and the water rose and fell on Colt and Charol. The swamp water found the Sun-Eater and extinguished it. It was dying. Without its light, it was just a beast, one no longer even capable of flight. It turned its diamond eyes on Colt and blinked once. Colt crawled toward it. Above his head, the Roog was laughing, growing bigger and bigger into the sky. Soon his head was level with the clouds. His legs extended down into the swamp floor. He had forgotten them. "I'm sorry," Colt whispered. He reached out, stroked the Sun-Eater's reptilian head. It felt warm, but no longer burning. He withdrew his hand. Then the Sun-Eater imploded. 9. It was a silent thing, the creature's entire mass compressed inward. Eyes and scales and wings broke up and shrank inward. Colt stared at the death of the Sun-Eater. Where it had been, there remained a softly glowing egg. 10. He carried Charol on his back, swimming to the shore. Charol had recovered enough to walk by then. They leaned on each other as they walked away from the temple complex. Behind them, the giant Roog was smashing up the ancient pyramids. It was like a child playing with its toys. Soon, if it weren't stopped, it would take over the world.
"What happened back there?" Charol asked.
I saw a god rising.
Colt said,
and a sun-eater die. Come, we must hurry.
Cheryl did not ask why. They walked away from the ancient temple along the riverbank before departing from it into the jungle.
I can't go any further, Cheryl said.
You have to, just over the next hill.
And Cheryl would comply, and Colt would make him go over just one more hill. They were not like the green hills of Earth, but they were hills all the same, and hard to climb. Hills often are.
You need medical help, Colt said. Lucille Town is 3 days away, by my estimate.
What difference does it make? Cheryl said.
We lost.
Colt shrugged.
We're still alive, he answered.
At the top of the next hill, they stopped and rested. They had a view over the jungle and the river, and in the distance they could see the swamp and the ruined temple. The Roog's head was lost in the clouds now. Soon, he would be visible from space.
No wonder the Atlanteans died out, Cheryl said.
Yes, Colt said.
He smiled, a private smile.
Look, he said.
They saw it before they heard it. The sound travels slower than the light, so that when they saw it, it was in total silence. It was hard to say afterward exactly what it was they saw. Certainly there was a flash of terrible brightness. The Roog's legs seemed to give way under him suddenly. It was the brightness of the sun turning everything white, and then the Roog was no longer there. Sound followed, a rolling thunder traveling for miles. The light dimmed only slightly. The flames rose upward, smoke erupting in a vast, towering mushroom cloud. Make no mistake, humanity has conquered space before, and out of that prehistory there came to us the ancient myths of the phoenix, resurrected in fire from ash. For such a creature could never have evolved on Earth. It seemed to Colt afterward that before the cloud dispersed, he saw a brightness, as beautiful as a bird born out of the flames, rise and take off into the air. The Sun-Eater being reborn in flame, like the phoenix. They sat on the hilltop and watched the sun rise over the Venusian skies. 11. In the distance, faint and fading, a final whisper in their minds.
Roog.
Then silence. 12. Colt was playing Venusian high-low and winning when Cheryl came into the bar. He was limping, holding onto a crutch, but he was smiling all the same. Colt smiled back. They had travelled through swampland and jungle to Lucille Town, under the shadow of the volcanoes. Neither was in good shape when they finally made it, but they had made it. That was the important thing. The city prospered. A lumber yard was operating at one end of the town, and the men were busy clearing away the trees. The houses were slowly being converted into permanent structures, surrounded by clean white picket fences. A new road was being built, linking the settlement to Port Smith. Everything seemed orderly, prosperous, and safe. One day, Colt thought, all of Venus would be like this. The colonists would drain the swamps, chop down the forests, build roads and towns all over the planet. Such a world would have no room in it for dwellers or sun-eaters. The old temples would become roadside attractions. The old gods would die. And such a world would have no place in it for a man like Colt. One day, Colt thought, but not today.
Got room for one more? Cheryl asked.
Colt moved his chair, and the man beside him
A gruff marine did the same. Cherol pulled over a chair and sat down. He put his hand briefly on Colt's.
"Deal me in," he said.
Paul Macaulay. Born in Oxford, England in 1955, Paul Macaulay now makes his home in London. A professional biologist for many years, he sold his first story in 1984 and has gone on to be a frequent contributor to Interzone, as well as to markets such as Asimov Science Fiction, Sci Fiction, Amazing, the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, Skylife, The Third Alternative, When the Music's Over, and elsewhere. Macaulay is at the forefront of several of the most important subgenres in SF today, producing both radical hard science fiction and the revamped and retooled widescreen space opera that has sometimes been called the new space opera, as well as dystopian sociological speculations about the very near future. He also writes fantasy and horror. His first novel, 400 Billion Stars, won the Philip K. Dick Award, and his novel Fairyland won both the Arthur C. Clarke Award and the John W. Campbell Award. His other books include the novels Of the Fall, Eternal Light, and Pasquale's Angel. Confluence, a major trilogy of ambitious scope and scale set 10 million years in the future, comprised of the novels Child of the River, Ancients of Days, and Shrine of Stars. Life on Mars, The Secret of Life, Whole Wide World, White Devils, Mind's Eye, Players, Cowboy Angels, The Quiet War, and Gardens of the Sun. His short fiction has been collected in The King of the Hill and Other Stories, The Invisible Country, and Little Machines, and he is the co-editor with Kim Newman of an original anthology, In Dreams. His most recent books are a new novel, In the Mouth of the Whale, a major retrospective collection, A Very British History, The Best Science Fiction Stories of Paul Macaulay, 1985 to 2011, and a new novel, Evening's Empires. Here he takes us to a remote mining station on the rugged coast of Venus's mysterious, fog-shrouded equatorial continent, where the well-armed miners are on guard for an attack by monsters. For all the good it will do them.
Planet of Fear by Paul Macaulay. Read for you by Tisha Donnelly. Across the glistening slick of the subtropical Sargasso, among shoals and archipelagos of bladderweed, several thousand sunfish floated in intersecting circles of churning foam. They were big, the sunfish, big, humped disks, 10 or 15 or even 20 meters across, patched with clusters of barnacles and thatched with purple-brown thickets of strapweed and whipweed, and all around them soldier remoras flailed and fought, flashing and writhing in frothing, blood-blackened water. A quadricopter drone hung high above the shambles, like a lonely seabird, avid camera eyes transmitting images to the ekranoplan anchored several kilometers beyond the Sargasso's southern edge. In the close warmth of the fire control bay, bathed in the radiance of three big flat screens, Katya Ignatova asked the petty officer piloting the drone to lock its cameras on a particular pair of sunfish. They were matched in size, each about 12 meters in diameter, and the fringes of their feeding tentacles had interlaced and fused and were now contracting, drawing them together. Dead and dying soldier remoras bobbed around them, slim, silvery torpedoes with chunks torn out of their flanks, shovel jaws gaping, eye clusters filmed white. Venusian fish were armored in bony chainmail, had external gills and horizontal tail fins resembling whale flukes, but they possessed swim bladders. Like terrestrial fish, their corpses floated. The drone pilot said, "Such fury, such waste." "Soldiers attack everything that gets too close to their sibling," Katya said, "including other sunfish. They can't mate until their soldiers have been neutralized. But the dead aren't wasted. Their flesh feeds the ecosystem where the next generation develops. She hunched forward as the pair of sunfish began to jab at each other with the spears of their spermatophores and asked the drone pilot if he could get a close-up of the action. No problem, he said, and made delicate adjustments to the joystick that controlled his little craft. The views on the screens tilted and shifted, stabilized again. Katya prompted the pilot to zoom in on the tip of a calcified spear that scratched amongst drifts of purple-brown weed before abruptly driving forward. I believe they call that the money shot, the pilot Arkady Sarantsev said. He was a slender, cynical fellow in his mid-twenties, a few years younger than Katya. She had noticed that he kept apart from the companionable clamor in the mess, reading a vivid paperback thriller as he forked food from his tray. Sitting close to him in the television light, she could smell the coconut oil he used to sleek back his black hair. It isn't sex as we know it, she told him. Sunfish are hermaphrodites, both male and female. If you could zoom out now. Yes, you see? Each has speared the other. They are exchanging packages of sperm, injecting them into special areas of haploid epithelial cells that will develop into egg masses. She planned to collect some of those egg masses in a day or two, when the mating battles were over, to test the hypothesis that they contained both fertilized eggs that produced juvenile sunfish and unfertilized eggs that produced haploid soldiers. She hoped that she would be able to examine the rich and varied biota of the Sargasso II, the swarms of isopods and shrimp and thumb jellies on which sunfish larvae fed, the tripod octopi and fish which fed on them. They really were amazing creatures, sunfish. They were eusocial, like ants, bees, and mole rats, with sterile, neotenous soldiers and fertile queens, which not only lost their bilateral symmetry, like flatfish or the sunfish of Earth, but also lost their digestive systems, their eyes, and most of their nervous systems. And they were also symbiotic associations, like corals or lichens, the dense fringes of feeding tentacles of the queens, which filtered and digested plankton and extruded strings of nutrient-rich nodules, which the schools of soldier remoras devoured, were derived from symbiotic ribbon jellies, the strapweeds and whipweeds rooted in their dorsal shells, pumped sugars and lipids into their bloodstreams. Amazing creatures, yes. And really not much like anything at all on Earth. Usually they led solitary, pelagic lives, drifting everywhere on the shallow seas of Venus. But every 17 years, they migrated to the Sargassos where they had hatched, possibly following geomagnetic and chemical cues, another theory that needed to be tested, and mated and spawned the next generation and died. Katya's observations and data would contribute to a multidisciplinary research program into their life cycle, part of the International Biological Year, a milestone in the growing cooperation and rapprochement between the Venusian colonies of the People's Republic, the United States, and the British Commonwealth. On the central screen, the two sunfish slowly revolved on the blood-black swell. On the screens to the left and right, a wider view showed other sunfish pairs ponderously locking together and surviving soldiers spending their fury on each other or on ripping apart smaller, unsuccessful sunfish. Katya asked Arkady Sarantsev to take his machine higher, was watching intently as it circled the entire area, trying to make sure she captured a good image of every pairing. When the Ekranoplan's turbofans started up with a shuddering roar, a few moments later, a seaman leaned into the hatch of the little room and told Arkady to bring in his drone. Captain Chernov's orders, he said when Katya protested, and couldn't or wouldn't answer her questions. She pushed past, hauled herself along the pitching companionway, and climbed to the teardrop cockpit that, with its pale wood and polished brass trim, the diffuse overcast of the cloud roof gleaming through its canopy, always reminded her of the luncheon room of the Engineers' Union, where her mother, the architect, I.V. Ignatova, took her every birthday for a ritual meal of beefsteak and cultivated wild mushrooms. The pilot and navigator were hunched in their horseshoe of switches and dials and computer screens. Captain Vladimir Chernov was enthroned behind them, sipping from a glass of black tea. All three wore bulky headsets. The Akranoplan had made a cumbersome turn away from the Sargasso, and now the pilot gripped the throttle levers by his thigh and eased them forward. The roar of the big turbofans mounted on canards behind the cockpit ramped up as the Akranoplan began to accelerate. Katya grabbed a spare headset to muffle the incredible noise and braced herself in the hatchway during the shuddering lurch of takeoff. She had learned the hard way that she could not speak to the captain in the cockpit until he acknowledged her, and he didn't acknowledge her until the Akranoplan was underway. An adaptation of the famous Korabl Makyet, the Caspian Sea Monster, it resembled a gigantic airplane, but was really a wing-in-ground effect machine that rode on the cushion of air generated by its turbofans and square, stubby wings. A long-range, lightly armed beast capable of speeds of up to 300 knots. It was making top speed now, skimming some 5 meters above long, rolling waves, skimming over breakers frothing across sea lily reefs. On its way to investigate an emergency at the People's Republic's most northerly outpost, Makarov Mining Station, according to Captain Chernov.
"I'm sorry about the abbreviation of your studies," he told Katya, "but the station sent a disturbing message 2 days ago and has not responded since. Although we are not the nearest vessel, we can reach it before anyone else."
He did not look at all sorry. He appeared to be enjoying himself. A burly, broad-shouldered, bullet-headed man dressed in the Navy's tropical uniform, blue shorts and a blue short-sleeved jacket over a striped tonyashka shirt, whose cool condescension reminded Katya of the sadistic anatomy lecturer who liked to pluck a student from the ranks and hand her a random bone and demand that she name it and identify the animal it came from. Captain Chernov was scrupulously polite to Katya, but did not bother to hide his scorn for her work and the collaboration with the Americans and their British allies. He was a war hero who, during the campaign against American libertarian pirates 10 years ago, had devised and carried out a daring, spur-of-the-moment raid that had ended with the capture of a particularly bloodthirsty warlord. Popular acclaim meant that the Navy couldn't cashier him for disregarding the chain of command, so he had been given a medal and promoted sideways to the Survey Corps, where he had been chafing ever since. When Katya asked him what kind of problem he was responding to, he studied her with remote amusement, then said,
"It is something you might find interesting, if true. The miners claimed that they were being attacked by monsters."
"Monsters? What kind of monsters?"
"Most likely the American kind," Captain Chernov said. As usual, he was speaking to a spot somewhere behind her left shoulder, as if addressing the ghost of an authority she herself did not possess. "If there really are monsters, if this is not some Yankee trick, you may be of some help. Until then, do your best to stay out of the way. My men must prepare for trouble."
The Akranoplan made the 2,000-kilometer trip in just under 5 hours. Katya studied the images captured by the drone, sorted them into categories, and made a few preliminary measurements. She ate a sparse lunch alone in the long tube of the messroom, which could double as a field hospital if the need arose, composing a bitter complaint to the IBY committee, the Marine Biology Institute, and the Ministry of Defense, which she knew she would never send. "Pick your battles carefully and fight them only in your head," her mother liked to say. "No one remembers the righteous who go to war and lose." The vibration of the turbofans created standing rings in her tumbler of water. She wondered about the monsters that had supposedly attacked the miners at Makarov Station. The shallow seas of Venus teemed with an extravagance of macrofauna, sunfish, cornet squid, mock turtles, and so on. But only a few large animal species had been discovered on the northern continent settled by the Americans and the thousands of islands and seamounts and atolls of the southern hemisphere. So finding a species of carnivore capable of killing a man would be a considerable coup. A swarm of pack-hunting reptiloids, some kind of super crocodilian,
Or perhaps, just perhaps, something as rare and strange as a tiger or a wolf. She went back to work, counting sunfish, measuring them, tracking the paths of individuals, trying to squeeze as much data as possible from the truncated observations. At some point, she noticed that the deep drone of the turbofans had diminished to a gentle throbbing. The Ekranoplan was afloat again, driven by its auxiliary engine as it nosed through dense billows of fog. Captain Chernov was outside, on the little railed observation deck behind the cockpit, with the chief petty officer. The two men wore pistols on their hips and were watching the long shadow of a shoreline resolve out of the fog. The shore of the mysterious equatorial continent. 2 billion years ago, the last great resurfacing era, vast quantities of molten rock from Venus's mantle had risen to the surface through long, vertical cracks in the crust. Injections of lava and differential crystallization of minerals had formed an enormous geological basin with distinct layered strata, including reefs of titaniferous magnetite gabbro and vast quantities of tin and iron. The basin had tilted and eroded and half-drowned, leaving only one edge exposed, a long, narrow continent that wrapped around half of Venus's equator. Most of its volcanic ranges and salt flats and deserts were scorching, waterless, and utterly uninhabitable. But a cold sea current rose at its southern coast, feeding banks of fog that grew during the long day and sustained an ecosystem found nowhere else on Venus. The People's Republic had established several mining stations there to exploit deposits of titanium and tin ore, copper and silver, platinum and bismuth, and to lay claim to the deserts to the north. This was the coast that the Ekranoplan was approaching, drowned in fog and mystery. An even, pearlescent light, streaming with particles and tiny, transient rainbows in whichever direction Katya happened to look. The close, clammy heat of a Turkish bath wrapping around her like a wet towel. The puttering of the auxiliary motor and the slap of waves unnaturally loud in the muffled hush. And something echoing in the distance. Faint, staccato, persistent.
"I see no monsters," Captain Vladimir Chernov said, turning to Katya. "But I definitely hear something. Do you hear it too, Doctor? Could you give your professional opinion?"
"It sounds like dogs," Katya said. "Dogs barking. Do they have dogs?"
"I don't believe so. Pigs, yes, to eat their kitchen waste and supply them with fresh pork. They are Ukrainian, the miners here, and all Ukrainians love pork. But if the records are correct, there are no dogs."
"Well, it sounds more like dogs than pigs. Someone smuggled in their pets, perhaps, or watchdogs were assigned to this place and the paperwork was lost or mislaid?"
"Perhaps. Or perhaps it is monsters that kill and eat men and bark like dogs," Captain Chernov said.
A fat pair of binoculars hung from his neck, a symbol of his status, perhaps. They were of no practical use in the fog. "It would be something new to science," Katya said, refusing to rise to his bait.
"Science does not yet know everything," Captain Chernov said. "Isn't that why you were studying the sunfish, Doctor? Not just to be friends with the Americans, but because you wished to learn something. We are at the edge of an unexplored continent. Perhaps you will learn something here."
"Or perhaps they are really dogs, American running dogs," the chief petty officer said. He was a stocky, grizzled fellow, with a scornful gaze who had even less time for Katya than Captain Chernov did. But at least they were direct about their dislike, unlike the chauvinist fossils at the Marine Biology Institute. And it had nothing to do with her being a woman who asserted her own opinions and refused to recognize her inferiority. No, they resented her presence because the IBY had many enemies in the government. And if its unstable mixture of science and peacenik appeasement blew up, the fallout would contaminate everyone associated with it. Which was why, of course, Katya had been assigned to the Sunfish Project by her bosses, and why she wanted to make a success of it.
"Dogs, pigs, monsters. We will find out. and we must do it soon, Captain Chernov told Katya, for once addressing her directly. The ice age of his contempt had somewhat thawed. He was relaxed, almost cheerful. This was Navy work. He was no longer answerable to Katya and the IBY. If the Americans are not already here, hiding from us or lying in wait, they will be here soon. They claim to have intercepted the distress call. They claim to want to help. There is no airstrip here. The terrain is rough. Too many steep hills and ridges. So everything comes in and goes out by sea. One of our frigates will be here in 3 days, but one of the American so-called research ships will be here tomorrow.
Makarov Station, strung along the edge of a natural harbor sheltered by a sandbar, was entirely obscured by the fog. It wasn't possible to survey it and the surrounding area with drones or lidar. Infrared imaging showed that the buildings, usually air-conditioned, were at ambient temperature. Apart from a man-sized trace perched on a dockside crane, there was no sign of the 26 people who lived and worked there, or of the monsters that supposedly had attacked them. The Ekranoplan dropped anchor, sounded its siren, sent up a flare that burst in a dim red star high in the fog. There was no answer from the shore, no response on the radio, no reply when the chief petty officer called to the miners through a loudhailer, and no one was waiting at the edge of the long quayside as the landing party motored toward a floating stage in a big inflatable. Captain Chernov sprang onto the stage and galloped up the steps, pistol drawn, followed by the chief petty officer, the drone pilot, Arkady Srensev, and 7 seamen, most of the Ekranoplan's crew. Katya followed, her heart hammering in anticipation. When she reached the top of the stairs, sweating in the damp heat, the men had already spread out in a semicircle, menacing the fog with their pistols and carbines. The skeletal outline of a crane, heaps of dark ore, the outlines of a string of small, flat-roofed buildings, and a tall radio mast faintly visible beyond, the persistent barking in the distance, tireless as a machine. Captain Chernov paid no attention to it. He was standing with his hands on his hips, looking up at the crane's scaffold stem. The jut of its long jib was veiled in misty streamers, but it was just possible to make out the shadow of a man at its end. He did not respond when Captain Chernov ordered him to come down, and he did not respond when the chief petty officer put a bullet into the steel plating a meter behind his feet. The sound of the shot wanged off across the muffled, fog-bound quay. Captain Chernov cupped his hands to his mouth. "Next one, he puts in your damn leg!" No response. They all stood looking up at the man. The monotonous barking had not let up, hack, hack, hacking away deep in the fog. "Take another shot," Captain Chernov told the chief petty officer. "I'll go up there," Katya said. "I distinctly remember telling you to keep out of the way," Captain Chernov said mildly. "I am medically qualified," Katya said. It was technically true. She had been given basic first aid training at Young Pioneer Camp. "The poor fellow may be hurt or wounded. He may not be able to climb down without help." "He may be an American for all we know," the chief petty officer said. "You can bring him down," Captain Chernov said. "I can assess him, talk to him. Whether he comes down, that will be up to him," Katya said, with that airy feeling just before a dive, before she toppled over backward into unknown water. As her mother so often observed, she had a knack of talking herself into trouble. "No, whether he comes down will be up to you, doctor," Captain Chernov said, turning now, favoring her with his thin, cool smile. "Don't disappoint me." The steel rungs of the ladder, dripping with condensed moisture, slipped under Katya's fingers as she climbed, slipped under the tread of her boots. When she reached the little glass and metal box of the operator's cabin, she clung to the handrail and called out, asking the man if he needed help, trying to sound encouraging, friendly. The man did not respond. He lay prone at the far end of the jib, arms wrapped around a steel beam as if around a long-lost lover. There were only 10 meters between them, but he did not even turn his head to look at her. She swore and swung up the steel framework to the top of the jib, trying to ignore the dizzying plunge to the ant-like cluster of people below. She called to the man again, asked him to tell her his name, and now he moved, rolling awkwardly to look at her without letting go of the beam. His eyes, sunk deep in dark hollows, seemed to be all pupil. "You're safe now," Katya said, trying to project a confidence she did not feel. "Come toward me. I'll help you down." The man's mouth worked, but no words emerged. He was young, younger than Katya, and wore blue coveralls and heavy work boots. "I'll come to you then," Katya said. But soon as she started to crab toward him, the jib shivering uneasily beneath her, the man humped backward like a demented caterpillar. She stopped, told him that everything was all right, that he was safe, and he closed his eyes and shook his head from side to side. He was crouched at the very end of the jib now, beside the cable wheel. Captain Chernov called out, asking why this was taking so long. The man looked down, then looked back at Katya, and slowly rose to his feet, arms outstretched like a tightrope walker, balancing at the edge of the foggy void. "Wait," she said. "Don't!" He did. Katya closed her eyes. A moment later, there was a hard, wet sound and a shout of dismay below. When she reached the ground, Captain Chernov said,
"Your treatment worked, doctor, but unfortunately it killed the patient."
The son of a bitch must have been working on that quip while he watched her climb down. She said,
"He was scared to death."
"Of you?"
"Of his worst nightmare, I think."
She was staring at the captain because she did not want to look at the splayed body.
"The crane is 20 meters high," the chief petty officer said. "Whatever he was scared of, it must have been very big."
"And it's still here," Katya said, pointing in the direction of the distant barking that had not, in all this time, let up.
"You are eager to make a famous discovery. But first, we must secure the station," Captain Chernov said, and detailed 2 seamen to stay by the boat, told the rest to stick together.
"Look after the doctor, lads," the chief petty officer said. "She isn't armed, she can't run as fast as we can, and she's probably a lot tastier than your salty hides."
"There were 26 people here," Katya said. "All men?"
"Of course," the chief petty officer said. "They were here to work. They didn't need distraction."
"All men," Katya said. "And they didn't do too well, did they?"